Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Symmetry of Soul, in-depth synthesizing study of the Urantia book for able and willing students. Tonight, paper 55. It's our arc on purpose and destiny. Advanced mortals learn that love is the greatest thing in the universe, and they know that God is love. Love is the desire to do good to others. We'll get there. That's kind of actually an advanced preview of how this arc kind of wraps up. But meanwhile, I'm Brad Garner. I'm so glad that you're here with us live on Tuesday evening or in our archive at symmetryofsoul.org. With me, as always, is Dr. Chris Halverson, our teacher. And there's Andrea Barnes and Kermit Anderson. And there's you. Please call up the text of the Urantia book by whatever means you deem appropriate and take a seat for about 1% of your week with us. Good evening, Dr. Chris.
Good evening, Brad. Thanks for your fantastic intros, as always. And hello, Andrea and Kermit and everyone that's joined us. We're starting our second series this evening in this long arc that Brad was just alluding to.
Yes, we finished our first series last week, and now we're fresh starting in a new paper, The Spheres of Light and Life. We'll get to that here in just a little bit. We always like to start the broadcast off with a little bit of a recap and then a little bit of reflection. Good evening, Andrea. How are you doing?
Just great, Brad. I'm glad to be here tonight. I'm looking forward to our new arc. And I just love my Tuesday nights with my guys and the study group. Glad to be here.
Glad that you're here. And our new series will be off to an excellent start. And Kermit, glad to have you here as always. I'm sure you'll take us back in time a little, remind us of how we wrapped things up last week, and of course, how are you doing, sir?
Doing very well, thank you. And yes, I will take us back. We did finish our first series in this long arc, as Chris mentioned. More discussion on the issues involved in extending planetary mortal lifespan emphasize the idea of the top-down, higher mind engagement enabled through genetic engineering. The resulting improved genetic foundation on which mind is seated allows for higher mind engagement, which, having a closer resonance with eternity, enables mind-body functioning in a greater harmony such that the body is able to retain life animation engagement longer, less resistance, resulting in increased longevity. At least that was the idea. True spirituality is indissolubly linked to the harmonious coordination and function of each cosmic intuition. Notably absent in conventional notions of spirituality is the integrous functioning of the mathematical form of the cosmic discrimination. Scientific consciousness, the first cosmic intuition. Urantia's post-bestowal age is most atypical. The apparent premature universal bestowal of thought adjusters allows for the spiritualization of loyalties without the adequate foundational principles of reality established through the previous planetary dispensations, that is, the planetary prince, material son and daughter, and magisterial son, thus setting the stage for the dangerous misapplication of the spirit ministries. We began our reading in Section 7, the last section of Paper 52, Post-Teacher-Son-Man. The Trinity Teacher-Sons differ from previous dispensational visitations in their origin, being offspring of the Paradise Trinity, the whole, and not of one or more of the three personal paradise deities. Jesus promised to return to complete his mission of spiritual uplift to Urantia invites speculation as to when he will come relative to the anticipated arrival of a magisterial son and Trinity teacher sons. Such speculation may be informed by the idea that before a holistic ministry can be of maximum value, the parts of a system need to be harmoniously balanced and potentialized. Note the synthetic method employed in studying the Revelation to sort out the details of the various designations of the Danels comprising the dispensational group assigned, that is, the planetary teacher sun, the primary, secondary, and supreme suns. No less than three different locations in the Revelation are consulted to obtain the specific information necessary to ascertain further significance to these designations. My summary contains those references, and listen to the discussion in the archive for an advanced method of study of the Revelation. Interestingly, in the synthetic journey mentioned above, we find that the Trinity Teacher's sons do not incarnate or otherwise materialize to become visible to mortals, but they work through the brilliant evening stars, whom mortals can see, inasmuch as in their advanced stage of evolution they are more closely akin to material sons and daughters. Universe administration is revealed up to the central universe during this dispensation. Also note, the planet is undergoing radical transformations of educational, economic, and administrative systems in addition to spiritual increase, so-called down-to-earth activities. Adjuster fusion is increasingly common, their universal bestowal having been inaugurated on the departure of the Paradise Bestowal Sun. Such father fusers also skip the mansion world training in increasing numbers to the point that the planet eventually is designated as of the primary modified order of mortal ascension, whereupon ascenders translate directly to the local universe headquarters. A true golden age is approaching. Trinity Teacher sons remain for 1,000 years of planetary time, completing successive missions punctuated by magisterial sun judicial actions. They can be thought of as cosmic uplifters fostering ever-increasing planetary allegiance to the Supreme Being. Still finite and mortal, the inhabitants of such a world are evolving a quality of near perfection. The inauguration of a world to the era of light and light is proclaimed by the appearance of the system sovereign and the elevation of the planetary prince to the position of planetary sovereign. It should be noted that this era of light and life is attained irrespective of historical antecedents of rebellion and default. The section and paper conclude with several passages from Scripture by Isaiah, Peter, and John's revelation. Such use of Scripture in the fifth epochal revelation should encourage all students to approach the Scriptures in a top-down manner and discern the truth contained therein. And here ends my summary.
All right. Thank you, Kermit.
Bravo.
Yeah, that was intense material last week. And I don't blame you one bit for saying listen to the archive to understand how we jumped around. That was a thrilling exploration, an example of how you can move through the Urantia book to try to synthesize things. And, of course, in the digital age, it's easier than ever to look for keywords and do some searches and do things that the first generation of readers couldn't probably even fathom, even with an index or a concordex or a concordance. I always get those mixed up. But anyway, thank you for the summary. Anything on anyone's mind or any technical clarifications, any things to bring up?
Well, the only thing that I thought was really that I've thought a lot about this past week is how these loyalties that we get, they're easy to get these loyalties spun up and hard to dislodge them. And the way you explained it in your review, Kermit, was really well put.
I had a question, too. They mentioned the 1,000-year reign and the successive missions of Trinity Teacher Sons. Is it successive? It's not successive 1,000-year missions. It's 1,000 years of this dispensation with periodic Trinity Teacher Sons. Is it not?
No, it's 1,000 plus 1,000 plus 1,000.
Oh, it is? Okay.
Yeah.
So, okay. I never did land on immediate clarification of that in any
There's
reference.
There's so many places in the book when they talk about where they talk about the Trinity Teacher Sons. As I recall, there is an explicit place. I just don't have it at the tip of my fingers.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay.
But
well,
yeah, that's sort of a question that, you know, you can have, and you see, so you go searching around, and you go, oh, okay, yeah, yeah, here it is. You know, that clarification.
Now I have to go back.
It's just so many, you know, examples like that throughout the Revelation. It's not, you know, not just minor issues, but major subjects where, you know, the full details are scattered all over in the Revelation. As I've always pointed out, if for no other reason, just to have a way for you to immediately be suspicious or inclined to engage the Revelation in a more holistic fashion. Because, I mean, it can't be a revelation of truth until you have, a synthetic grasp of the coordinated essential knowledge. If you're still, in a factoid mode, there's no effective wholeness to your relationship to the facts, you can't get to the truth. I mean, it's only in that the wholeness of that coordinated essential knowledge that your encirclement in the Holy Spirit can kind of reciprocate the vantage point of your mind so that you naturally engage things from the top down, starting in the sphere of truth, and then are reborn in the top down relationship to the facts. And you
the
begin
Holy
to
Spirit.
See the depth of all those facts that you'd been accumulating beforehand.
Go ahead, Kermit. This is your line of thought.
Well, I just wonder also if the idea that this is of multiple authorship plays into that somewhat as well, that that you'll have different authors coming at different angles within the sphere of truth and coming up with coordinate information that appears to be scattered about.
Yeah, I mean, obviously that technical issue of why, it gets distributed, exactly what you're saying. But, just the mind-boggling precision of the transcendent coordination across all those authors, it boggles the mind because you're thinking bottom-up. So how do they pass enough memos back and forth to get everyone so precisely on the same page.
Right. What kind of managing editor
right.
do they have? Well, maybe they don't need a managing editor.
No. See, if you start with the truth, right, you're automatically on the same page.
They're
operating in that sphere of truth.
Clear down to precision of word selection. Right, coincidentally, right, quote unquote, right, they select the exact same phrase, right, to describe something. It's not coincidental. That is the phrase in English, and the only phrase to describe that.
You don't think
truthfully.
They got together ahead of time and had some kind of over, a big document that spelled out, like, for example, look, we're not going to use the word nice in this entire book.
there definitely was a document. They refer to that. These mandate
Indeed.
Documents. But once they've been given those lines, right, for them to paint within, they just all go off and paint. Right,
wow.
And they're absolutely unique personalities, and they're not all just one puppeted set of paintbrushes.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And some of them work in mixed media. Some of them rework pre-existing material. Others have to conjure, like, all new material. So,
yeah.
But it all works.
Right.
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 Yeah. And you know, occasionally when you're doing a very focused investigation, you can just stand in awe of what you discover at how transcendently the book is composed. You know, it just boggles the mind how transcendently it's composed. A set of passages scattered throughout the entire book, if you pull them out and put them in book order, that's the story order of those passages on that point.
Wow, yeah.
I mean, it's just, you know, amazing when you see things like that.
What it brought to mind for me, was the greatest lecturer I've ever met. I mean, just a towering intellect. Okay, I haven't met. It's a virtual role model online. But he was explaining how he came to grow his intellect. And one of the things he did during his college undergrad was each of his summers. Summer number one, he read all of Shakespeare. Summer two, he read all of Plato. Summer three, he read all of Nietzsche. And he said that gave me something I could hang the rest of my learning off of. And he sort of implied that he had a synthetic understanding of those three major authors, you know, one from antiquity, one from Renaissance, one on the precipice of the postmodern. But anyway, my point is, you know, to have to work through Shakespeare, as brilliant as it is, it's quite a disparate catalog reflecting different evolutions of a animal origin beings' thoughts on something. You know, to try to work unified themes and see the truth flowing through Shakespeare, that's a tall order. That might be a lifelong pursuit. But what we have in the Urantia book, I'm not saying it's easy. I'm just saying the Urantia book does have an essential unity to it, a certain quality that will allow you to engage it in a holistic fashion in a way that you might not ever be able to with Shakespeare or Plato, or heaven help you ever with Nietzsche.
Yeah, not to mention helping you avoid, you know, the brilliant scholar that takes the pile of works that is Shakespeare, you know, and uses his, you know, vast rationalization engine, you know, to construct an apparent synthesis.
Right.
Right.
Risky.
You know, when you start talking about this, this logic of the whole, this synthetic engagement. Don't assume that, wow, I'm finally going to transcend the pitfalls of falsehood because I'm getting above mere fact. It's like, no, now you're actually getting to falsehood. Right? it's in the context of the wholeness. Right? So, you know, you may find a logic, an apparent logic, you know, just airtight. Every I dotted, every T crossed, but it's a false logic. You know, so, this is why eventually on a world they get the spirit of truth. Because eventually you need that fourth cosmic intuition so that you have a direct intuition about truth itself. Rather than just this bottom up, within the context of the Holy Spirit, you have these three intuitions and, you know, a super summative synthesis, you know, upward from them kind of begins to get you into the wholeness of truth. But, you know, you're struggling. It's like, okay, I think this is truth. It's an airtight synthetic logic, that puts it all together. But I wish I had some reality response directly about this now fourth fact I'm working with, this wholeness. You know, am I engaging it, true or false?
Yeah.
And that reality response is out there, but you have to take delight in cultivating the antecedent conditions to be sensitive to it.
And as I describe it that way, it should be easier for people to understand. You know, they don't want to be too quick to say, oh, yeah, man, I'm all over using the Spirit of Truth.
Right.
You know, as the Spirit of Truth. It's like, no, you're not. That is a very advanced thing. I mean, we just read about how advanced the beings are before a normal world is even given that, you know, because they need it.
Yeah.
You know? Right. I mean, yes, you immediately are benefiting from that spiritual ministry as its basic spirit nature of being the spirit of unification, so that you can get an adjuster, even though you're a seventh circler. But using it, you know, transcendently as the spirit of truth itself, a fourth cosmic insight, that's a very advanced engagement.
Yeah.
So as comforting as a passage like the Spirit of Truth will always speak, saying this is the way, as comforting as that can be in times of trouble, in dark hours, don't count on it being just as easy as that sentence might suggest.
It's effective, see, super consciously, right, in the way, you know, you just, you know, reminded us of that passage. But to actually wield it as one of the tools in your toolbox?
Yeah.
That's another matter.
They would mostly, well, if you're out there talking about, I use the Spirit of Truth to figure out that quarterly report, if that's just the height of hubris and child, hopefully childlike ignorance, willful childish ignorance.
Yeah.
Quarterly report, that's good.
Yeah, boy, that spreadsheet was transcendent from your use of the Spirit of Truth on it, Brad.
Oh, heavens.
Yeah, so, yeah, just, but, you know, I mean, it's, you know, it's consequential, as you're reminding with that passage again, for us to just hear those words so that we have an even deeper appreciation of grace. You know, we should never doubt in our firm knowledge of the depth of grace that has been poured out upon us. Right? And so take a deep breath and let go of your fear, you know, and humbly and patiently begin to work your way up the ladder of grace until you need grace no more because you have taken the reins.
Yes.
And you fuse.
There you go. Well, let's see. I had one other thing here. You know, I was just thinking back on our series that we just completed there, and I'll admit, even though I've read that paper quite a few times, to study it in depth like that, to slow down and go section by section, as we got toward the end, as the narrative of that kind of a world began to be said to us, it became more and more abstract to me. It was easier to distract me with shiny objects, like a cat with a laser pointer on a wall. And I'm sure that's just my lack of synthesizing ability with the book right now. But I mean, it's also it all felt quite remote. And
yeah.
I guess I just wanted to sort of declare that and at least let one person out there in the audience know, you know, if you were feeling that, you're not alone. One of the co-hosts was feeling that way.
Right. I mean, I was trying to, you know, emphasize it as we're going along. It's like, you know, now, let this recede from, you know, certainty of comprehension. You know, less and less do we really have a clue of what they're talking about here. Don't delude yourself otherwise. You know,
right.
Otherwise you have all sorts of unfortunate thoughts about, you know, if, you know, we just rearrange the deck chairs on the Titanic, we're going to have light and life tomorrow. You know, it's just, it's a long, long ways off, you know, in ways that we can't even begin to imagine.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Well,
you know, what is it? What is it like when you have a world where, you know, the least of the creatures, you know, the humans, is far transcendent of Jesus when he was here.
Right. And yet, not everyone still might be getting thought adjusters or something crazy like that.
Yeah.
It certainly was. It's illuminating and it's humbling to say, "Well, I'm certainly not that," but it's also humbling in a different way to say, like I just referred to there. Yet by grace we all get thought adjusters, and yet we would not be allowed to reproduce on one of those advanced worlds where they don't all get thought adjusters. It might be able to change the way you wake up and have your feet hit the floor every day of your life if you really let it act on you. What does that mean? You've been given a thought adjuster when creatures far more advanced than you don't get one. I mean, just don't take that for granted. Don't get puffed up about it. Just don't take it for granted.
Yeah. Right.
Right.
Again, it's you don't have to get into the physics of manipulating the spirit of truth or your thought adjuster. Just knowing that it's there, the depth of grace is effectively infinite. The adjuster is a fragment of infinity.
Right.
Yeah. So, you know, there's repleteness of grace. You know, and just so, like I said, you can take a deep breath. Don't let the vicissitudes of the world, I'm calling them vicissitudes because they are molehills. They're not mountains, right? If you can let yourself rest firmly on grace, you can see them for the molehills that they are. You can deal with them, or maybe you can just endure them. But you get to the other side.
Is everything down here a molehill?
there are anthills.
I need to know.
Yeah, I mean this is pretty much, Benny Annie stuff going on right now. Yes.
Mm-hmm.
I mean the only exception is is your personal relationship to eternity, right? I mean that infinitely transcends the minor issues of a primitive people like us. I mean, in that regard, it's everything. Right? That's why you want to, you don't want to be flippant about that. And that's, as I talk about grace, you could start to think, well, and there's just like he just said, there's effectively infinite grace. So, I can kind of just, not worry about it. I can just let my spiritualized mind do whatever, feels fancy today and call that righteousness. Like, no, you can't.
Yeah.
because if you've actually spiritualized your loyalty and other aspects of your agitated mind, you've transcended the molehills of the world. Your inner life is transcendent of the external world. It's transcendent of your outer life. And it can quickly pile up to a mountain of doom because spirit brings in geometric rock piling. So you need to take that seriously. As Jesus said, you get through the door, but then you face a severe test because now you're playing with real consequences.
How do you know if you've been born again, Chris?
Well, that's a little bit off topic right now, but there's some basic passages in the book that one can consider, some coming right out of Jesus' mouth. Right, to try to help us to think about that issue. We've talked about some recently, Andrea. One in particular, is is paper 137, section 8, paragraph 8.
Okay.
You know, and just, you know, it's not a whole bunch of complicated physics to try to wrap your mind around, but just that basic statement of Jesus pointing to what kind of a consecration is involved in being born again. You can ask yourself a courageous question.
Yeah.
You know, have I begun to strive for a nobility of character like that of my father? Right? Like the universal father, even more transcendent, like father deity, right, to be precise. Right? Is that, you know, the first overarching principle in your life? Right? That you're going to always say, okay, you know, thinking this way, accepting this in my life, is that striving for the nobility of character that is indistinguishable from that of Father Deity? You know, am I consecrated like that? Right? Or am I distracted by material things?
Yeah.
You know? You know, am I like, you know, again, another kind of intro to being born again passage from Jesus. Am I like Nicodemus? Mm-hmm. You know, and, you know, have I not quite gotten to that initial recognition point that, that is being born again? Right? You know, I mean, how does he say it there? You know, he's kind of a... You know, Nicodemus says, but I do not understand. How can that be? You know, the whole bit of being born again, he's just, you know, befuddled by it. And Jesus says, can it be that you are a teacher in Israel and yet ignorant of all this? It becomes then the duty of those who know about the realities of the Spirit, see, who have been born again, to reveal these things to those who discern only the manifestations of the material world. See, there's another clarifying little statement. Right? Do I only discern the manifestations of the material world? I mean, one of the greatest, quote-unquote, religious people, right, of Jesus' day, Nicodemus, Jesus says, huh, so you just testified that you discern only the manifestations of the material world, and yet you call yourself a religious teacher in Israel?
He was an unwitting secularist long before it was fashionable.
Yes. Right. I mean, you know, he's just natural. We all start out only discerning, you know, we can't do anything but the manifestation of the material world. And in general, we get very intrigued there. And as we mature biologically, we just have fancier and fancier illusions about the manifestations of the material world, which we start to get so fancy, we start to call some of them spiritual, but has nothing to do with spiritual. That's Nicodemus, calling very fancy, you know, so-called sacred manifestations of the material world spiritual. Right? And making a whole elaborate, you know, faceted doctrinal construct, you know, out of that fascination with the manifestations of the material world.
The examples are endless. It's the ism problem.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You know, and then as Jesus points out, you know, he can say that. Okay, so obviously you don't know anything about spirit. So it's, you know, it's up to me to and others like me to broach the subject with you. But then he says, but will you believe us if we tell you of the heavenly truths? Do you have the courage, Nicodemus? Remember, courageous and independent cosmic thinking? Do you have the courage, Nicodemus, to believe in one who has descended from heaven, even the Son of Man. And you don't have to go that far to put it literally back in that historical context. Right? Do you have the courage to believe in something that you can discern, you can know, that is completely apart from the material world and is not your imagination? It's going to require courage not only to trust that it's going to be okay if you stop resting your sense of integrity on some material construct, of some evolutionary religion, but when you actually do become spiritual, you notice that Jesus used the word duty. As soon as you spiritualize your mind, you now are face to face with the divine law.
Yeah.
Okay. Now you weren't face to face with that anymore. You were sheltered from that scary fact by grace of just being an animal origin clueless creature. But there it is. And you know there it is. The fear of the Lord is the beginning of wisdom. Right? That's being born again. Right? The most glaring thing that strikes you is the fear of the Lord. Right? The recognition of the existence of the divine law, period. Right? It's like, well, can it just be whatever I want or whatever I feel like that day? Nope.
Yeah, I don't. I think a lot of people, I know a lot of people are missing it then, because there's a lot of feel-goodism, feeling-based thoughts about being born again out there. You know, everything is soft and fuzzy. The only part that's not soft and fuzzy is the death on the cross and that atonement. And that was really rough for a few minutes there, but now everything is just as easy as it gets. That is a misconception.
I mean, Satan told everyone to call Lucifer the God of Liberty because everyone could see that in Lucifer's so-called good news, no longer were you face-to-face with the divine law. You've liberated yourself, from that notion that there is such a thing. That was invented by the foreign potentates to keep you, in line. That's their boogeyman.
Good heavens. Sounds an awful lot like Nietzsche. Okay, but I digress. just on a slightly higher supermaterial level, but it's the same idea. Okay.
Yeah.
Interesting.
Right. See, and this, the fact that this is so, that you can so naturally kind of slip into this, knowing nothing of the actual facts of the Lucifer Rebellion 200,000 years ago, it's just innate. And another thing that's up there when you spiritualize your mind is a direct recognition of what the word liberty is for in contrast to the word freedom. That you are literally sovereign there. Right? What you're supposed to do with that liberty is put it in law, to take your sovereign liberty and put it in the divine law context. If the law part is scary, it's like, if I close that eye, that's much better. Now there's just liberty.
Yeah.
I just have to keep my eyes shut.
I get it, Chris, that you say it, that's just coming naturally, but I also think there are people who very deliberately and with great intellectual heft ponder this stuff. I mean, Foucault, good heavens, absolute liberty, do whatever you want. If it feels good, do it. What a monstrous philosophy, but what a towering intellect. It wasn't an idle thought. So.
Right. Yeah. mean, the reason that there was such vast dark consequences to the Lucifer Rebellion is you can't imagine how brilliant Lucifer is.
Right, right.
Think of the ism that he can spin. Leaves any human, you know, godless ideals ism in the dust.
Yeah, for sure.
It will be so brilliantly seductive. You know, you'll forget you ever even thought of the word God. It's like, who needs God when there's this glory? We're susceptible to just the minimal threads of godless ideals that, you know, some human can spin. See, someone is religious when they don't shy away from the fact of divine law.
Okay, that's nice. Yeah.
Now, right, unquestioning loyalty and wholehearted devotion to supreme values. Right?
Mm-hmm.
That they don't turn away from the recognition that there is the divine law. Now, obviously, initially, you'll have some primitive notion of what the divine law is. But that detail is irrelevant. It's in the evolutionary context, base or even false, right? As that passage says, right? The key is the sobering purity that any recognition of quote unquote the divine law brings into a human's life, and how that bounds you absolutely away from the oblivion that Lucifer encouraged you to head towards. It turns you in the opposite direction from that. Right?
Mm.
So it doesn't matter if you're completely primitive and superstitious in what you think the divine law is. You have your back to oblivion. And the universe honors that.
Yes, that makes sense.
The person who has all kinds of really sophisticated, non-superstitious beliefs, but is facing right and walking ever quicker towards oblivion, that's a problem.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Well, remember the they make a point throughout about entrance into the kingdom is as a child, and children get in the kingdom, and they're nurtured by the kingdom attendants, so to speak, the spirit ministries and the powers of light. So before you get to these super sophisticated levels of thinking, you've made tremendous strides. Hopefully, you began to have confirmative and helpful experiences growing from a child up into adulthood. And then socialization of those experiences are recommended so that you don't get spun off on false tangents. But that entering as a child is keenly important.
Right. And again, it's just to recognize that, the quote is not the fear of the Lord is everything. No, it's the beginning of wisdom, right? It's a journey towards adequate wisdom that is sparked, in parallel to that journey by that faith grasp, right, that puts you into an actual evolutionary religion of fear, right? It's still a fear. You haven't been born again into a revelatory religion of love. You've got a long journey, upward in parallel to that faith grasp to get what it takes to have the super additive leverage to rotate yourself 180 degrees in your inner life and plant your feet on eternity. Okay? Instead of temporal fear. But, you know, nothing can begin. You actually, you know, to recognize that even though the Jesus' apostles kind of immediately lost track of what you know, he told them precisely and kind of went, you know, fully into an amped up evolutionary religion of fear, it was such a definitive, powerful new evolutionary religion of fear that it eventually produced the Enlightenment, see, in parallel to it, like I just said, that journey. Right? And if you could have taken that born-again, basically compartmentalized away from the scientific growth, if you could have taken that with some fullness of some scientific growth and put the two together, right? You know, you could have gone forward, but instead the scientific side began to wane, and you know, and the religious side, you know, just couldn't stand compartmentalized apart. It was, you know, it's too child of God-ish, right? And it just kind of eventually gets washed over by, you know, the refutation of superstitions by the scientific side. And so you just, mm-hmm. you lost it all. You know, you lost all of the precursors. You know, we were quivering on the very brink there of putting the two together. But now it's all slipping away. You know, the people that think they're religious really aren't. They're, you know, at best ritualists. You know, as they point out, 300 years of the Enlightenment turned most of, you know, religionists into mere ritualists.
Hmm.
Right? And they're unwittingly actual secularists. And, and you can tell that by the fact that they give countenance to godless ideals. Right? They've turned their eye away from the divine law. And again, as the ancients knew, if you turn your eye away from the divine law, even your prayer is an abomination to God.
Mm-hmm.
Right. So they're obviously not religious anymore, see?
Christianity was hibernating indeed. Yeah.
Yeah. So, yeah, that was kind of a tangent, but you know, it's an important element to, you know, to bring it back to our arc here. You know, we're talking about purpose and destiny in this long arc of you know, the progressive advancement of civilization on a world and the progressive spiritualization of individuals to the point where you begin to actually need a cosmic uplifter of a Trinity teacher son. You know, and you've reached evolutionary utopia. I mean, remember, all of that only happens with religionists.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that doesn't happen with, you know, people that are, you know, just, you know, they call themselves spiritual, but really it's just, you know, feeling full about material things, and they're nice.
Sentimentalism, that sort of thing.
Right. I mean, Adam and Eve were very, very nice people. They went in, that got them default. Lucifer was a transcendently nice person. That got him rebellion. You know, it's just, you need much more than being nice. You know, because, you know, in the way we tend to use that nice, it's got the literalness underlying it. You know, underneath all of that properness of you know, sort of obeying the social norms, you're nice, you're ignorant. The literalness of the word. You're ignorant of the cosmos. Right? And that eventually, you know, bears fruit. Dark fruit. Ask Adam and Eve. and if you wonder about me calling Lucifer nice, if that's appropriate, it's like, no, remember he said, I'm the friend of men and angels. You know, he goes, you know how mean those people who put themselves over you are? You know, they make you do this and that, and they say, if you don't do this, you know, you're a sinner and blah, blah, blah. No, I'm your friend. Right? Now, I'm the nice person here. You know, what do you need? Do you need help with better food distribution, you know, on your planet? Well, we'll bring it to you. Now, I'm a nice person. I'm not like those mean people that say things like Jesus said, that he who will not work, will not work shall not eat. I mean, how mean is that? That's not a nice person. I'm nice, says Lucifer. See, that's the spiritual candy of his sophistry.
And it was ruinous.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, you know, it's a very different image of evil and sin than what we're used to in the anthropomorphic, nightmare-based ghost cult concepts of evil and sin.
The ghost dream. Goes all
right.
The way back to the ghost dream.
It's all based on dreams, remember. You know, so there's pleasant dreams and there's nightmares, right? And that gives you dual spiritism. Right? And so, you know, the fact that we're losing that recognition that, you know, it sin, evil and sin are about something, you know, more than just these issues of socially pleasant or not, you know, socially helpful or not. To appreciate the only way, you know, we're about to read about a world in light and life, the only way they got there is with genuine religionists. Now, and the only reason the Urantia book is here is because we have fewer and fewer and fewer, you know, even primitive ones, right? Let alone, you know, advancing ones. It's just so important to remember that you can't get to light and life by just more and more clever rearranging of the external world. It all is predicated on the inner life. And if everyone has short-circuited that, right, you stall out. You have to initiate the inner life's influence in the world by being born again. Otherwise, you don't really have any influence on the world. It's an illusion.
People have written about that for a very long time. People far smarter than anyone on this call figured that out thousands of years ago.
Yeah.
So,
yeah. So just, you know, it's just to appreciate that it, you know, Andreas, yeah, when all is said and done, that's a great point to bring up. What about this religion thing? What about this born again thing?
You almost don't want to ask it because you think, well, I should know, so I'm not even going to ask this question.
Yeah. Right. Because Chris might, you know, say the very thing that Jesus said to Nicodemus. Can it be that you are a teacher of the Urantia book and yet are ignorant of all this?
Yes, it can be.
See? But to have the courage to just—it's like, okay, that's not some—you know—that's just the way we all begin, completely ignorant of what born again is about. You know, and it doesn't help if, like Brad said, if there's people who have some sort of a, you know, an emotionalism notion of what born again means. You know, let's be more fervent in the lower domain and call that born again. It's like, no, born again is about going up.
Yeah.
Yeah. Not, you know, not turning the burner up on the lower domain so that it's a fervent boil. That's not it.
Yeah, radical.
Mm-hmm.
All right.
Okay.
Well, let's get into our reading this evening. I think we could loosely say that all of that conversation was relevant. You know, particularly we brought up Lucifer, and just as a program note here, we are skipping over papers 53 and 54. That's the Lucifer Rebellion and the problems of the Lucifer Rebellion. Those are certainly favorites among the readership. There's plenty to find out there, and I feel like our authors, after laying out planetary mortal epics, they, like, I don't know, I'm sure they were far more sophisticated. It's like they strummed their fingers on the desk for a few minutes and said, you know, the planet really isn't normal. We should get some people in here to talk about why. So that's how we got 53 and 54, I think. But anyway,
yeah,
now we get back
what
to...
What can get in the way between 52 and 55? Rebellion.
What can what can keep you away from light and
there
life?
It
what
is.
Can yeah, what right. Darkness and death can intercede, yeah.
Yeah. Do you think it's a coincidence those two papers are in between, you know, these two? No, of course not.
No. No.
How do you short circuit purpose and destiny with rebellion?
Yeah. So there you
go. You can do it on a system wide scale, or you can do it in your little inner life all on your own. Right.
That's a great point. So the architecture of the book. Yeah, go ahead, Chris.
Yeah, just one. You know, we're gonna let me just say it since we're meeting the kind of, we're about to read. They're gonna remind us of the sequence that we just went through in paper 52. But you know, remember when you talk about post magisterial son, he's trying to get them to be born again, and then the post bestowal son, the bestowal son is trying to get them from born again up to born again again. Right, that's where those two fit into the sequence. You know, the Adamic proceeds to get the genetics up to where you can get basically everyone born again. Right? They don't have genetic, you know, boat anchor that's, you know, holding that down. Right? So you liberate the boat anchor, you get people born again in the magisterial sun age. And then the bestowal son comes to lead them up from there through recognition, realization, appreciation, and love, born again to a revelatory religion of love.
He would lead them up, but they're more interested in him making more free fish and bread. So,
yeah.
You know, most of the time. But anyway.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay.
All right.
Go ahead, Brad.
It's paper 55 of the Urantia book, The Spheres of Light and Life. Page 621 of the original single-column text. The age of light and life is the final evolutionary attainment of a world of time and space. From the early times of primitive man, such an inhabited world has passed through the successive planetary ages, the pre- and the post-planetary prince ages, the post-Adamic age, the post-magisterial sun age, and the post-bestowal sun age. And then, is such a world made ready for the culminating evolutionary attainment, the settled status of light and life, by the ministry of the successive planetary missions of the Trinity Teacher Sons, with their ever-advancing revelations of divine truth and cosmic wisdom? In these endeavors, the Teacher Sons enjoy the assistance of the brilliant evening stars, always, and the Melchizedeks, sometimes, in establishing the final planetary age.
Just two little things I'd like to highlight there. Remember, we were putting forward we could call it initially a hypothesis, that you could call the Trinity Teacher Sons the cosmic uplifters. See, with their ever-advancing revelations of divine truth and cosmic wisdom. Yeah, as the cosmic uplifters. you just kind of see it over and over again. It's like, well, what would be the pithy expression for all these things that they say? Yeah, cosmic uplifter. And then the other point is, you know, why give us those details again? You know, you could say, well, you know, they just got us off track with the Lucifer Rebellion and stuff, and they have to remind us of what happened in Paper 52. But, you know, think of our ARC title. The purposing, right? The very fact that there's these definitive, distinct, you know, ages, right, is a reminder of precise purposing. Right? There's a sequence. There's a specificity. Even that final statement, you know, we talked last time about how you always have the brilliant evening stars as the point contact people for the Trinity Teacher Sons that are invisible. But then they say, and the Melchizedek sometimes. It's like, well, why? Well, you know, you don't have to try to somehow get all the way to that level of the physics of all this. Just, oh, so on some worlds, because of the precision of purposing and play, they're required. You know, just to you know, always kind of start with that lens of how is this just reminding me yet again, you know, that all of this precise order is a reflection of precise purposing predicated on an absolute divine law. And just to see that endless detail of precision and how every world is engaged as if it was the only world. You know, it's engaged very precisely. This world needs this many Trinity Teacher Sons missions. This one also needs, you know, this number of Melchizedeks doing these special things, etc. And not coincidentally, of course, right, you always have, oh, gee, it's handy that those beings exist because, boy, we need them right now.
Yeah.
Yeah. It exists because the end is known from the beginning, as it were. In something as kind of seemingly technically bland as a paragraph like that, just, you know, let yourself, you know, feel the security that wraps around your life. The universe is precisely managed. No real harm can befall you unless you choose it upon yourself.
Yeah.
Wonderful.
It is. And, you know, and don't, I mean, we all have a long way to go with our synthetic understanding of the Urantia book. We all do. But don't underestimate. If you can read that whole paragraph and have a rough working understanding of all the words in there, like, you know, a first-time reader, they'd read that every other word just doesn't parse. Post-bestowal son? What? But if you can read that and at least grasp, like, yeah, sure, of course, obviously. Well, I mean, this is such an obvious paragraph. Why are they telling this to me again? Yeah, that happens and that happens. Like, well, you've already assimilated a great deal of content. So, you know, never forget to – don't rest on your laurels, but acknowledge the laurels if you do have them. So,
and it's not an arbitrary human, you know, fashioned order that you've assimilated. It's the cosmic order that you've assimilated.
Right. This isn't Nietzsche. This is the cosmos.
I'm always fond of saying in my friendly conversations, the universe is not a pinball game. It is a creation. Yeah. Nothing random going on here.
Nope.
And it's a lot more fun than a pinball game. But,
yeah. Just because it looks like chaos doesn't mean it really is. In fact, I was listening to one of the old broadcasts yesterday, and they were talking about how every morning there's a meeting with the Most Highs and some of the archangels, and just went on and on about who all is there every single day, making sure everything's just fine.
Yeah, And there's always that guy standing in the back of the room, the Most High Observer.
he's just observing.
Who can step in just in case someone misses something.
This era of light and life, inaugurated by the Teacher Sons at the conclusion of their final planetary mission, continues indefinitely on the inhabited worlds. Each advancing stage of settled status may be segregated by the judicial actions of the magisterial sons into a succession of dispensations, but all such judicial actions are purely technical, in no way modifying the course of planetary events.
You know, they haven't given us the fullness here. A couple more paragraphs to go, but just saying each advancing stage. Okay, so just in case you're going to let your mystical bliss fuzz everything out into the era of light and life. It's like, no, there's a physics to it. There's precise stages that they're going to talk about, and you know, and they may be segregated by the judicial actions. It's like, wow, did that poke a pin in your mystic bubble, you know? Judicial actions of the magisterial sons, reminding you why they're called magisterial sons. So, again, the purposing, right? There's all this precision, right? There's all these details. But now, we talked about how, you know, when we were going through planetary mortal epics, and we used the word dispensation, there, it wasn't merely talking about dispensational resurrections like they're talking about here. You know, each dispensation literally had a different type of mortal. Here,
right.
The mortals aren't being changed from one dispensation to the next. They're light and life mortals. It's kind of like, you know, you have this very definitive, you have to be turned off body change going from one mansion world to the next, but then finally you graduate from that, you know, and the same body goes forward. You know, it gets, tweaked, but you literally don't have to shut it down and toss it in the recycle bin and start with a fresh new body. So we're in that mode in light and life. So you still have group resurrections, right, of a dispensational scale even, you know,
right,
beyond group and millennial, perhaps. But you're not fundamentally changing the entire triune energy environment and hence the beings that exist within it. Does that make sense?
It does. Yeah.
Although we're coming up on these other stages, I would assume there may be some grander adjustments that might look like what you're talking about.
Yeah, there's all kinds of adjustments going on, but see, in no way modifying the course of planetary events like before. You aren't literally kind of respawning. You know, the types of mortals, they have what it takes. Now they're just going to synchronize that ever deeper and broader with the cosmos.
Yeah.
Right.
Just briefly, this paragraph made me think, when I read continues indefinitely on the inhabited worlds, it made me think of World One in our system, ANOVA. They say it is in an advanced stage of progressive civilization. Well, the last item on that list of in progressive civilization is the era of light and life. Is it likely that ANOVA is in the stages of light and life?
Oh, yeah, I mean, yeah, you've got worlds that are, that are way deep in the seventh stage of light and life.
Yeah. Sure. Right here in our own system.
Sure.
Right.
Yeah.
Sure.
Yeah. If it is appropriate to think in blocks of 200 with our local system, Right. You know, we're in the third block. Well, that first block at 200, I mean, yeah, they were, you know, they were going hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of millions, you know, of years before anything was going here.
Yeah.
Think of how far along in light and life they are. Yeah, we just went through the numbers of going through those stages, you know. It didn't add up to, you know, 500 million years to get to light and life.
No, it
no,
certainly
that's right.
didn't. No, it didn't.
It certainly didn't.
That's almost analogous to our ascension career, where fusion occurs really quite up front in the grand scheme of things, and we go you know we get fused fairly soon here.
I mean, there were inhabited worlds in Nebulon 200 billion years ago. 200
right.
billion years ago.
Yeah, they're not right. they're not in the they're not in the material comfort era anymore.
Yeah,
no,
not hardly.
But it's comfortable
how
there.
How many
bet.
Confusions there might
yeah,
have
yeah.
been? You know, they've worked through everything over that span of time. So
quite a history
yeah.
book they must have there. Yeah. Well, all right. Only those planets which attain existence in the main circuits of the super universe are assured of continuous survival. But as far as we know, these worlds settled in light and life are destined to go on throughout the eternal ages of all future time.
So they're, you know, they're not just talking about inhabited worlds, planets in general. I mean, remember, you're evolving everything sort of to architectural sphere-like status and eventually Havona-like status. So
right.
we've talked about this before. I mean, eventually there's no Jupiter, right? Some blob of gas, you know, whatever.
Yeah.
Right? I mean, you're going to have, you know, eventually you have only the planets, you know, that have been locked into some sort of centralized circuit system, you know, a super universe downstepped expression of the central universe, you know, with its seven circuits, the main circuits, see, of the super universe, and not all the sub-circuits, the main circuits. In other words, going around the center of the central universe, of the super universe. Just like the Havona circuits go around the center of the central universe.
The main circuits, yeah.
Main circuits.
I didn't know that.
Right. And, and of course there's mindful and spiritual, you know, aspects to that too, besides just the material. But there's also the material, and you can think of the circuit in a more literal, geometric fashion. Eventually, you're going to settle this whole thing from an evolutionary system, you know, that, if you don't know much, you could think is just some old spiral galaxy like you see out in the outer space levels.
Right.
To something that's not at all, right? No one's going to look at the central universe and go, oh, it's just another spiral galaxy. No, it's a billion worlds precisely in seven circuits. Nothing evolutionary about it. Yeah, not one
so
single,
that's the perfect,
you know, stray molecule in the entire central universe.
So we'll be completely,
not one stray molecule.
The grand universe will be completely perfected as a realm of perfection for sure, but achieving it through evolutionary means.
Right, with tweaking. You know, and as we read, you know, they're especially the physical stuff, there gets to be more and more overt, just manipulating into that state. In the same way that, if you kind of imagine rolling the grand universe proper forward in finite evolution and getting it, in personal terms, settled in light and life, Well, the almighty supreme part, the purely, you know, power pattern part, you know, is not just within the super universe, I mean, the grand universe proper. I mean, there's all the finite evolution in the outer space levels. Right? And so, see that, you know, in the same way, when you get towards the latter stages personally, you know, the almighty supreme, you know, is going to be just, you know, there's going to be just an exponential wave of locking it into place that will, you know, go out beyond the grand universe, right, throughout all of the finiteness of the master universe and lock that entire evolutionary thing into place.
Never thought that far ahead.
And we're going to see that on micro scale with a planet. You get it to the fifth stage of light and life, and you know it's getting, you know, locked into place in grand sweeping fashion like that. It's it becomes personality managed completely in the moment, not over the long term. Right. There it is.
Well, now getting back to this paragraph, though, you wouldn't think in any inhabited planet designed to harbor evolutionary mortals, they're going to attain and be existent in the main circuits. Not going to have a Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy problem of an inhabited planet being destroyed to make way for something else.
As far as we know, these worlds settled in light and life, right? Right. So they're reminding you that you know, our world is locked in because it's, you know, the Creator Son's bestowal world. You know, there could be, you know, some cases, you know, that fit into that thing of, well, we're going to have to evacuate this world, right?
Oh,
but
that's true.
That,
sure,
you know,
right.
That's all in the rearview mirror once you get a world of light and life.
No more planetary doom, right?
Yeah, there's no more possibility that, you know, the inscrutable plans of the architects of the master universe just can't be managed by all of the countless number of master physical controllers. You know, and there needs to be a plan B, you know, down below.
back to the drafting board, yeah.
Right. I mean, there's just reminding you that there's always going to be some point, you know, for some reason, sooner or later, where, okay, you know, if we have to move heaven and earth, okay, this one gets locked into the main circuits, and that's, you know, that's period. Everything else is going to have to adapt to that fact.
There are seven stages in the unfoldment of the era of light and life on an evolutionary world. And in this connection, it should be noted that the worlds of the spirit-fused mortals evolve along lines identical with those of the Adjuster Fusion series. These seven stages of light and life are...
Go ahead and just read them.
One, the first or planetary stage. Two, the second or system stage. Three, the third or constellation stage. Four, the fourth or local universe stage. Five, the fifth or minor sector stage. Six, the sixth or major sector stage. Seven, the seventh or super universe stage.
Okay, they're going to mention in the last paragraph here, the preface, that you not only have kind of the immediacy of this list of, you know, having seven stages of light and life on a world, and then, okay, kind of maybe mysteriously but nonetheless paralleling with this hierarchy in the cosmos, planetary system, constellation, etc. But the reason for that is, separate from a world, there's the bigger picture of the evolution of the grand universe, as a vast universe of universes, heading towards getting settled in light and life. And, you know, a planet gets settled in life, eventually all the planets in a system get settled, all the systems in a constellation, all the constellations in a local universe. You know, we'll see when we get there. The minor and major sector ones aren't that literal on the big scale, you know, until finally a whole super universe of local universes is settled in light and life. So there's two modes in which we're going to talk about this, you know, planetary, you know, and how, you know, when a planet is in the fourth stage of light and life, it has the essence of the local universe being settled in light and life, even though, you know, that's a long way off yet, literally.
Right? Oh,
that
okay.
One world
I wondered how that works.
Essence of it, way begin, you know, way
yeah,
before
okay.
that. Okay.
Right.
And then the other little thing to just point out, because they mention it directly here, before we get to section one, they mention the spirit-fused mortals, all the long lines identical. Well, when we get, you know, see the title of the next section about the Maranta Temple, and those that know the book, okay, that whole bit about having a Maranta Temple, and one of the things that happens therein is, you know, fusion ceremonies. Okay, I mean, you know, worlds that are just spirit user worlds, period, forever, you're never going to have spirit fusers, even if the world is in seventh stage light and life, fusing on their nativity sphere. Right. It's,
right.
It and says always, they fuse right. when they're resurrected, you know, wherever they're resurrected on high.
You're right.
Yeah, with a fragment of the Creative Mother Spirit.
So they all die.
It's there's no fusion flashes going on with those spirit fusers on any worlds, no matter how deeply they're settled in light and life. That doesn't change. And, you know, just to remind yourself that, that's not kind of the exception to the rule, like, you know, always like it is in Nebadon. You know, back in paper 49, the next to the last paragraph in section 5, they tell you that almost 90% of the inhabited worlds of Nebadon are peopled by adjuster fusion mortals. You know, say almost 90%. Okay. In contrast with a nearby universe where scarcely more than one half of the worlds harbor beings who are adjuster indwelt candidates for eternal fusion.
Section was that in? That's paper 49,
section 5,
what?
The next
I'm
to
sorry.
Last paragraph in section 5, paper 49. They have
okay.
a little
okay.
preface to the adjuster fusion series discussion there.
Yeah.
Right? And so just that reminder that there are whole local universes that are highly dedicated to the production of spirit fusers.
Right, right.
And that's okay. And that's okay.
And that's okay.
That's what it's supposed to be.
That's what it's supposed
lose.
To be.
Yeah.
Yeah, they didn't draw
it's okay
the short
stack
or anything. But, yeah, there's going to be a lot of worlds in that local universe, right, that, you know, where there's no fusion flashes on any world, even, you know, when the entire local universe is settled in light and life. That will all happen, you know, after those mortals are resurrected. So it's a very different phenomenon, see? You know, and you can, you know, we won't do it because, you know, we'll go off into mystery land. But it gets you into all sorts of curious questions like, well, wow, how does that work if you have a really advanced mortals like that? I thought when you wake up as a spirit fuser, you have no connection to the life before and all that. And right, see, it kind of brings in a lot of mysterious questions when you take those worlds into very advanced stages to kind of think that through. But nonetheless, just want to make that point here when they're talking about spirit fusers.
Yeah, that's fascinating.
Well, Andrea, would you like to take the reading from here?
Sure. Thank you, Brad. At the conclusion of this narrative, these stages of advancing development are described as they relate to the universe organization but the planetary values of any stage may be attained by any world quite independent of the development of other worlds or of the superplanetary levels of universe administration. Oh, boy.
See, like I was just saying, the planetary values, or I could say the essence, see. But the full substance of the local universe stage waits upon every, you know, world in that local universe getting settled in life, enlightened life. So, you know, if you're the first world in a local universe, you know, you're waiting a long time, all right, for the substance to roll around.
Mm-hmm.
And you would in essence, you could, in essence, embody then the seventh stage before the actual fourth, before that actual local universe kicks into light and life. So you could be very advanced
seventh stage
as an individual world. Right.
Yeah, you have seventh stage planets that, you know, in a system that's not settled in light and life.
Right. Yeah. Right. There you go.
You could have a seventh stage planet, you know, and maybe you haven't even initiated life on some of the worlds in the local system yet.
Right.
Right. So it all depends on how spread out it is and whatnot, so in time.
Okay. Should we go on?
Yep.
Okay, number one, the Marantia Temple. The presence of a Marantia Temple at the capital of an inhabited world is the certificate of the admission of such a sphere to the settled stages of light and life. Before the teacher sons leave a world at the conclusion of their terminal mission, they inaugurate this final epoch of evolutionary attainment. They preside on that day when the holy temple comes down upon earth. This event, signalizing the dawn of the era of light and life, is always honored by the personal presence of the paradise bestowal son of that planet, who comes to witness this great day. There, in this temple of unparalleled beauty, this bestowal son of paradise proclaims the longtime planetary prince as the new planetary sovereign and invests such a faithful Anonidec son with new powers and extended authority over planetary affairs. The system sovereign is also present and speaks in confirmation of these pronouncements. I wonder who our guy will be when we get to that point.
Yeah, whoever the system sovereign will be at that point, we don't know. But apparently, right, that's when Machaventi Melchizedek in his unique role will become planetary sovereign.
Right.
Yeah, that's what it appears at this point anyway. We kind of talked when you're ending up paper 52, how they're alluding to Revelation 21, like they are here again about the, you know, and why they're calling this the temple, you know, and whatnot. They're leveraging off of those visions, and those descriptions, and you could have people saying, well, maybe. Yeah, maybe Michael's not going to come again until this time. It's like, well, no, that doesn't make sense because, you know, you can't get to this time unless there's a full implementation of a bestowal son. So, no, he must come before this time. But he will definitely be here at this point again. Yeah. Yeah. So that's a great example, great way you can, you know, recognize that you're not going to get this world going along, and it's like, you know, and then, oh, no, it got steamrolled because you had to put in a new cosmic highway, and Michael's going, well, wait a minute, I had it on my schedule to show up for, you
the,
just
the big,
eradicated
the big
my world?
Yeah.
Like, no, see, it's already in his daytimer. The world will be here for his appointment. But it's fun, you know. It's delightful to, you know, to just read that first part of Revelation 21 and kind of see how many of these, these recognitions of a world and light and life are there.
Mhm. Yeah, that's interesting. Why they gave him a vision of such a faraway time.
Yeah, and remember the whole bit about, you know, the New Jerusalem, right?
Right.
You know, the temple comes down, and that's the New Jerusalem. It's like, well, okay, not quite, you know. But let's call the local system headquarters where the plans for it come down from. We'll call that Gerizim, playing off the word Jerusalem. I see, just to make it all the more parallel to Revelation 21.
Yes.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that's what they did.
Mm-hmm. A Maroncha temple has three parts. Centermost is the sanctuary of the paradise bestowal sun. On the right is the seat of the former planetary prince, now planetary sovereign. And when present in the temple, this Lenonidec sun is visible to the more spiritual individuals of the realm. On the left is the seat of the acting chief of finaliters attached to the planet. Brad, doesn't this just conjure up visions of so many movies where you've got these really elaborate throne rooms and, you know, you imagine all this. It must be pretty cool.
Yeah, although it's all so beyond our imagination. Like, all my imagination can do is have a gigantic, mostly empty room and a very bored person sitting in a chair in the middle of it all day. Like, I know that's not correct, but I have no basis for filling this room out with anything.
But there are some comic books where when you go to that place, there's actually three cosmic overlords that you find in that throne room. So, See, that's a parallel here.
There you go.
Yeah.
Can you imagine the pretenders in the audience? Yeah, I see him. Of course I see him. Sure I see him. I'm spiritually advanced. What do you mean? He's sitting right there.
Yeah, and I wanted to point out, you know, you brought up in your review, Kermit, about, the whole bit of, I was talking last week about the lifespan, you know, reflecting the more eternalized mind, you know, and the mind has a body, and so the body lasts longer, stays animated longer. See, they're referring to it here directly again. See, the more spiritual individuals can see him, right? Spirit is self-animating. Right, so that life animation, see, stays with the material body longer. It's very literal physics. The same reason that they now can actually see the Lenonidec sun, well, forming context of the temple, but nonetheless, they can see him. Right, that's related to how long their bodies go on before the second law of thermodynamics, you know, disintegrates them. They're literally more spiritual, more mm-hmm. more self-animating like.
Yeah.
Hmm. Okay.
And then there's also, you know, the spiritual individuals of the realm. The realm means the world.
Yeah.
Yeah. Calling it a realm because you have a planetary sovereign now.
Right.
So
very directly appropriate, right? Call it a realm.
Yeah.
A realm. Huh.
Yeah. A royal domain here, you know. A domain of royal reign or whatever you want to say, right? A realm.
Although the planetary temples have been spoken of as coming down from heaven, in reality, no actual material is transported from the system headquarters. The architecture of each is worked out in miniature on the system capital, and the Maroncha power supervisors subsequently bring these approved plans to the planet. here in association with the master physical controllers, they proceed to build the Marantia Temple according to specifications. I'm sure it's with one of those new those things. What do they call them? Where they have a machine that just kind of makes
3D
it right
printer.
Into
yes.
It. Yeah.
That's exactly what I was thinking. Yes.
It has to be.
Just says, just email the software specs and we'll print it down here.
Yeah.
Yeah. And there's a degree of, you know, of appropriateness to that analogy because, you know, it's literally just in the, you know, in the volume context presence of these beings that automatons and spirit energy, you know, are brought together into a structure.
Right.
And it just coalesces in their presence.
Wow.
You know, they don't build it brick by brick. So, yeah, the entirety of it just coalesces into existence, just like an architectural sphere does. Yeah, but again, you know, coming down from heaven, you know, those references. But just, you know, a little, you know, to think about, you know, as grand as that, you know, is to think about them, quote unquote, 3D printing the Marantia Temple, there are distinct limitations to what even the celestials, even the best of them, as it were, the grandest of them can do, right? You know, you can't go full massive science fiction in your imagining here, you know, that the celestials have super colossal, you know, like planet-sized motherships, right, that go around the galaxy and could transport, you know, whole temples or anything. It's like, no, you have, you know, single occupancy transport seraphim.
Yeah, those are the rules in this universe age.
Right. You know, and not only so that is there that sort of quantity limitation of what's transportable, the super universe, you know, each super universe segment of the super universe level is this vast domain, you know, and these minimal transport, you know, vehicles, these transport angels can only go at 3 times the speed of light, tops.
Right, poking right along there.
Yeah, you think about it, it's a curious portrait of a cosmos, like compared to our sci-fi fantasy literature. Like the most common things transported around are building plans and shrubs, you know, and souls. Like, that's it.
So, to pause and, you know, think about what's kind of between the lines of some of this. That, you know, in some ways, our imagination has gone way beyond, you know, what reality is. But in another ways, as we were talking early on, you know, we can't even remotely imagine what a world is like in a normal post-bestowal sun age.
Mm-hmm.
Notice the difference between the two. One, we're imagining quantity, you know, and kind of going too far. The other, we're imagining quality and can't really get any distance at all.
See, that's interesting, yeah.
Right.
We're that minimally spiritual.
Yeah.
Right? We have conversations on this planet about what is born again?
And we have to keep reminding ourselves, yeah.
Yeah, that's how minimally spiritual we are. That's like, you know, having a conversation. What exactly is material birth? Can you explain that to me? I can't even imagine what that is. Right? I mean, you know, in real terms, that's what our conversation is. Right? And the universe looks at us that way. Okay, we're talking about creatures on this world that don't even know what birth is. Right, so we all need to be very humble, because with that limit of a nature, if we're not humble, and yet we've been, you know, all this spiritual engagement has been thrown at us, we could get ourselves in a lot of real trouble if we aren't humble.
Mm-hmm.
'Cause we don't have a clue what we're talking about, you know, and what we could possibly be playing with. Right? Spiritual matches are dangerous to play with.
Hmm.
Right? Just like physical ones are in a mortal sense. It might burn the apartment complex down.
Right? Well, Kermit, would you like to take over the reading there? Sorry, Chris, I didn't mean to cut
you
off.
Sure. No, that's fine. Yeah, you know, just one little thing. For those who aren't familiar with the Revelation as well, you know, this mysterious mention of the Marantia power supervisors. So they have to come to the world. You're going to have Marantia substance now in the world, which doesn't just sit there by itself. It has to be held together by the Marantia power supervisors. You know, and you haven't needed them until now. But that reminds you, it's like, well, wait a minute, I thought all our souls are Marantia objects. Yeah, well, that's the mystery of Ascendington. How is it you can have Marantia objects, you know, that aren't natural and stay together when you don't have Marantia power supervisors to hold it together?
Yeah.
Yeah. If you get in a, you know, if you get a Marantia body on the first mansion world and stow away on a rocket ship, you know, stow away on the Enterprise, and go screaming off away from the presence of a Marantia power supervisors, your body unravels.
I hate when that happens.
So, yeah. But yeah, here we're going to have, you know, overt Marantia structures and stuff on the planet, and you need Marantia power supervisors to not only assemble that but to maintain that.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. The average Marantia temple seats about 300,000 spectators. These edifices are not used for worship, play, or for receiving broadcasts. They are devoted to the special ceremonies of the planet, such as communications with the system sovereign or with the Most Highs, special visualization ceremonies designed to reveal the personality presence of spirit beings, and silent cosmic contemplation. The schools of cosmic philosophy here conduct their graduation exercises, and here also do the mortals of the realm receive planetary recognition for achievements of high social service and for other outstanding attainments.
Oh, man, I was looking forward to the World Cup there.
No play.
Yeah.
No play.
It's like three Rose Bowls right there.
But yeah, instead, what do you get? You know, in the wake of the cosmic uplifters, you get silent cosmic contemplation and the schools of cosmic philosophy graduation ceremonies. Yeah.
Pomp and circumstance going on eternally.
Because, you know, only about things that we can't even wrap our minds around. To use that term cosmic philosophy is, you know, is an attempt to take sort of the fullest, kind of most transcendent sense of philosophy, you know, like when I talk about the lower hemisphere of human philosophy and the upper hemisphere of a true metaphysics, a revelation, divine revelation, and having a whole sphere of philosophy, you know, now take that up and up and up in transcendence till, you know, it's effectively a Moda-like wholeness. Yeah, that's what they're getting at with that expression, cosmic philosophy. Moda-likeness to a very high degree, long, you know, even before you have a mirage of mind.
Wow.
Wow. I'm just continuing to be humbled by the descriptions of things here, like, you know, special visualization ceremonies. Like, we read those words and we're like, all right, I guess I know what that means. But you know that the authors were like, okay, how do we describe this to these people? This would be like us trying to go back 2,000 years ago and explain to an apostle what a Pentium computer chip is. You know, it's like it's like writing down math really fast. Like, how would you even, you know, so how do you begin to describe a special visualization ceremony? Well, yeah, that's the understatement of the evening. I mean,
yeah.
We have no idea.
Yeah. Not to mention the surround soundness, quote unquote, of the event. The immersion aspect of what's going to be going on, and, you know, in ways that we, you know, can't even remotely imagine.
Right.
You know, that we're not just a billiard ball in a vacuum like we think we are now, right?
They will not
to have
be
this
Moda-like huge
consciousness, you know, to be much more, you know, engaged with the system of motion that you're in and everything. And, so very transcendent.
Yeah. I think it's fascinating what you just pointed out, Chris, about how readily we can quantitatively expand our imagination to unbelievable and absurd dimensions, and yet be very limited in our ability to expand on quality
yeah.
parameters. That's quite an insight.
That's
such a Marantxa temple.
We have material
also,
minds, you know. Yeah, I'm sorry, Kermit. That's just we have material minds, and they're amped up, so we can imagine a Dyson sphere, you know, the size of, you know.
Right.
But can we imagine, you know, being born again? No.
Right. Think about that for a while. Right. Such a Marantxa temple also serves as a place of assembly for witnessing the translation of living mortals to the Marantxa existence. It is because the translation temple is composed of Marantxa material that it is not destroyed by the blazing glory of the consuming fire, which so completely obliterates the physical bodies of those mortals who therein experience final fusion with their divine adjusters. On a large world, these departure flares are almost continuous, and as the number of translations increases, subsidiary Marantxa life shrines are provided in different areas of the planet. Not long since, I sojourned on a world in the far north where on 25 Marantxa shrines were functioning.
Remember, we got worlds in Nevadon that were initiated, inhabited, and you know, the life was initiated 200 billion years ago. So,
it's like 4th of July all the time.
You're going to have some worlds where, yeah, there's just a nonstop series of massive hydrogen, you know, bomb explosions. But notice it's more than that. See, that's a really key thing. I mean, this isn't just a material stadium that can hold 300,000 spectators. This is made out of Marantxa substance. Okay, a Marantxa being can stand at ground zero when they explode a hydrogen bomb and it does nothing to you. Okay.
Not so with the other citizens.
When you go fusion, see, it's, you know, it's not just electronic level energy release. It's a sub-electronic level phenomenon all the way down to the, literally unraveled all the way down to a cloud of automatons. You know, and that impacts a Marantia structure. Except the one that just fused with a thought adjuster. So again, a mystery. So why doesn't the person's soul get obliterated?
Yeah, because it's a Marantia object too.
Because a fragment of infinity has a hold of it and stands unmoved by the fusion flash.
And protects it or something.
Your
that
adjuster
which,
holds you together, yes.
That which God has put together, no one shall take apart. Yeah.
Yeah. Yep. Yeah. See, just the literalist of that. So you go out in a blaze of glory. You know, I mean, you die spectacularly. You know, your mortal self, you know, goes out in a blaze of glory. But your adjuster holds your Marantia soul secure.
There's a great Hoyt Axton song called Going to Heaven in a Flash of Fire. I don't think he had any idea.
No. But yeah, it just, you know, the literalness of things, you know, like not only some of the same statements in Revelation, you know, but just expressions like going out in a blaze of glory. It's like, no, that's a real thing. And you don't want to be anywhere near it when it happens. You know, when we get to the section two next week, you know, we'll talk a little bit more about this. But you know, this is a, you know, you want to extrapolate, you know, quantitative terms to extremes to imagine just how much energy is released in this event, and what has to be done to protect. They say it's composed of Marantia material that is not destroyed by the blazing glory, like I was saying, you know, I mean, a Marantia being can be standing, you know, but, you know, there's a little bit more details they haven't given you yet. There's beings that are involved in this too. Channel this. You know, it's you know, it would be interesting to know just how much strain the temple is under when it happens. You know, it's probably not just, well, it's none. It's not under any at all. It's like, no, I don't think so. I think it, you know, probably. You know, it does feel the strain a bit.
And yet there's an audience watching this whole thing, too, so they're
sweating
a little bit.
Yeah.
We don't
want
any
grandstands. They're very much hoping that the beings, you know, as we'll read about, you know, are going to protect them, you know. But, but just to think about, you know, because like they pointed out, this Marantia material, you know, it's material atoms kind of opened up and with spirit energy woven into them. You know, that's why the master physical controllers were involved. So it's not like it's completely, you know, devoid of relationship to physical phenomena, at least, you know, if you go to a deep enough level. So to think a little bit beyond the immediacy of what their words, right? So that you aren't just kind of thinking, oh, it's all magical so it doesn't get destroyed and whatnot. It's like, no, there's physics to it.
Yeah. Okay, final paragraph. On pre-settled worlds, planets without Marantia temples, these fusion flashes many times occur in the planetary atmosphere, where the material body of a translation candidate is elevated by the midway creatures and the physical controllers. Yeah, I was just wondering about that, like with Enoch and Elijah and so forth.
Yeah, and what it takes, I mean, not only do you have to, you know, get him up there, you know, I suppose the midway creatures, but you know, you've got to protect the atmosphere to some degree, you know, so hence the massive physical controllers, and, you know, we can only kind of speculate on what all is involved so that, whoops, there goes the atmosphere of that planet. We should have shielded that event more.
Or don't drop him too soon.
Yeah, right. Or don't drop him too soon or whatever, yes.
I mean, no, do you think have they had accidents in the past? Is that what they've got to dial in now?
What do you think the Tunguska blast?
I was thinking up headlines.
Yeah, the Tunguska blast.
Yeah.
Come on. That's
yeah, I know.
Theory.
Because you notice it says these fusion blasts many times occur in the planetary atmosphere. It's like, well, that better be a pretty vast desert, though, if it's happening somewhere on the planet. Maybe you just take him. You could take him down to the ocean. You know, if there's a really big ocean and there's this blurp of water that comes up. This is one of the delightful paragraphs in the book where you can kind of just speculate endlessly. It's like, okay, that's intriguing. What are the details of that? But yeah, the main point is, aside from the details, is that these are a colossal energy event, and this needs to be managed. If you just let someone fuse in the middle of New York City, okay, forget about New York City.
Now here's our sci-fi material again. Yeah, we're back to that.
Yeah, they just vaporize everything.
So what about Enoch? He fused. I mean, was he out in the desert?
Well, no. See, they're telling you probably. See, he was lifted up into the atmosphere and. Now he walked with God and was no more. Walked with God. Lifted up into the atmosphere.
Chariot of fire. Yeah.
Yeah.
So, but he was still in the atmosphere. I mean, that is, so they didn't take him way out into deep space or anything.
No. Like I said, I mean, the physical controllers are probably, directing all the energy safely away, you might not have wanted to have been in a spaceship going around the Earth at an appropriate time at that point, but the death
so
rate
you hear about
goes out.
That have... supposedly been through spontaneous combustion. That's a bad case of gas or something. That's not the same thing.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. The mysterious thing about that is, most of the chair the person was sitting in is still there.
Right.
Yeah.
See, you can tell from this, no. Yeah, his chair, his house, his block, his entire city, most of that state would be gone. little different. Yeah, and just in the minute we have left here, I mean, why? Why, it's besides the fact that the body is, is being unraveled down to the ultimate atomic level, remember that the soul is fusing with this adjuster, which is not just the spirit fragment. It's as much an energy fragment as well.
Oh, that's right. Pure energy. And
its
spirit.
Energiness is allowing it to protect the soul. And there's going to be some sort of rebound off it or a reaction with it. I mean, the adjuster's energy nature is probably involved in the enormity of the explosion too.
Wow.
Well, it's all deeply designed, and it does sound like something out of sci-fi, but it's really something. Well, that's where we've got our study to this week. We are off and running in paper 55 here, talking about Marantia temples and people blowed up real good. Okay.
Yes, they did.
Tune in
emphasis
next
on
Tuesday.
The real and the good in UB terms.
Wow. Well played. All right, that's where we'll leave it for this week. Tune in next week for more fascinating discussion. I know I will. Follow the way.
God bless everyone.
Good night, all.
Yes, take care, everyone. As hard as it is to believe, I'm going to talk about death and translation next time, and we'll have great fun. Take care, everyone.